With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marie.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's sports car racing podcast in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine. John DeGee's back in Chicago, fresh off of a trip to Shanghai. You know where you are yet? What time it is?
Not yet. A couple red-eye flights and coming home to snow. It's a bit strange, but I guess that's how it goes when being a reporter covering international racing events.
That's right, exactly. And so we'll have plenty to talk about with Shanghai. Of course, we've got an interview with one of the winners from the LMP1 ranks, Gustavo Menezes, who was part of the Rebellion race-winning lineup. He'll be joining us in a little while. We've got plenty of news to get to on the show this week and some listener questions. But it must be said, we do start this podcast with heavy hearts after the passing of Dr. Tim George, who passed away during the IMSA Encore due to a medical problem during the course of the race. And John, it's never easy to lose a member of the motorsports family, especially so when it comes during an event.
Yeah, really sad situation on Sunday at Sebring. Dr. George was driving the number two ANSA Motorsports Liger at the time. Apparently, he had some kind of medical emergency, came into the pits. Track medical workers attended to him as quickly as possible, transported him to Sebring, to a Sebring area hospital before he was declared dead. And really sad, Dr. George was a competitor in some of the IMSA championships over the years, most notably in prototype lights, I think in 2015, 2016. He had done a couple LMP3 races as well, as I believe. And he was an accomplished neurosurgeon based in Austin. And I guess he worked in was one of the top children's hospitals over there. So it's a huge loss, not only for the motorsports community, but for everybody back in Austin as well. So, it's we're all with heavy hearts right now.
No doubt about it. So our condolences to the friends and family, the team as well, everyone associated with Dr. Tim George. We were very sorry to see that news. The race, however, did go on. Results from the Encore and LMP3 47 Motorsports drivers Tristan Nunez, Jonathan George, and Joel Jenko had the win in that class. GT3 Riley Motorsports had the win there. Lawson Aschenbach and Gar Robinson teaming up to win in that class. The GT4 class also won by Riley Motorsports with Jim Cox and Dylan Murray as the driving lineup there. So you can head to sportscar365.com for more from the Encore over the weekend. But let's get to what you were doing over the weekend, John, which was the WEC round in Shanghai. It was a historic win of sorts for Rebellion. We knew that this was a good chance for Rebellion to take advantage of the lack of pace that we expected from the Toyotas, given all the success handicap that they had accrued from the first couple of races of the season. And they did break through with Bruno Senna, Gustavo Menezes, and Norman Nato. So I guess a brief recap of the race would be in order, and then a discussion of whether or not the success handicap accomplished what it set out to accomplish. We did have a different winner, but there's still plenty to talk about on that subject.
Well, from a pure entertainment standpoint, I would say this was probably the most exciting LMP1 race I've personally seen since the exit of Audi in 2016. We had the Ginettas leading out front the first hour. Toyota briefly led before the Rebellion took over the lead. There was slicing and dicing in the first, five, six laps between LMP2 cars and whatnot. But all of that was a bit artificial, in my opinion. And actually, some drivers sort of agreed with me on that, including Sebastian Buemi. We have a story on Sports Car 365 about that, about his views on the situation. It all was definitely influenced. It was definitely based on the success handicap. And it made it good racing, but yet again, it was we all knew heading into the Shanghai weekend, this was probably going to be Rebellion's best chance of a victory. The team was very bullish heading into the weekend. I remember speaking to Gustavo on Thursday, and he was saying, we have a very good shot. We're going all out. We've made some further gains on the car since Fuji. The team had some problems with tires in Fuji in terms of just getting the tires to work. This is a new development tire for this season that was developed specifically around non-hybrids. Up until now, the LMP1 non-hybrids had been running the hybrid spec tire. The tire that was basically developed for the Toyota, Porsche, and Audi LMP1 non-hybrids. So they were at a big disadvantage because of not having a four-wheel drive system. So Michelin worked really hard during the offseason to bring them a tire more suited to these cars, and there were definitely high expectations. Rebellion, though, wasn't as quick at the start of the weekend and really left a lot of people's wondering what was going on. Even the team, Toyota, was making allegations of potential sandbagging, not quite going out and saying that, but inferring that they should have been. Toyota, Pascal Vassilon, Toyota's technical director, told me that they should be at least 2.5 seconds quicker than they are right now. I don't know what's going on. And then we started putting our heads together thinking, well, is there any reason to sandbag? Because of the success in the handicap system, there's still so many questions here with all of these new variables added into the championship. So once the race started, it didn't look good for Rebellion. Norman Nato had a very poor start, which we sort of learned later on was a bit controversial, as three of the five cars ended up getting drive-through penalties for jumping the start. And there's allegations that Norman may have held back a little bit to try to potentially force those cars to get jumpstart penalties, and that's a whole other story. But even with those penalties, Rebellion still would have won. They ran away with the field. They won by over a minute. It seemed like once they were on fresh tires, the car just came alive. And it was a really incredible effort by the team, a flawless run, other than that early first stint by Norman where he was marred back in, I think, fifth or sixth overall behind an LMP2 car. He was on used tires, the qualifying tires he had been on, and that was the real weak point for that package with the way the success handicap was applied to that car. They were, I think, 0.9 seconds slower per lap per the handicap compared to the Toyotas, which are 2.7 seconds slower per lap here this weekend at Shanghai. So it made for some really crazy racing because, the Ginettas, which were the benchmark, the number six car in particular, was the benchmark for the success handicap. So they didn't have anything on the car, and that thing was a rocket ship. It was about 20 miles an hour quicker than the Toyotas in a straight line. And that's where it sort of became a little dicey, especially through traffic, overtaking. But we saw a really crazy race, and I think for fans back at home, some of the fans, if any, that made out, well, there were fans at the track. We'll say that it was down a little bit from previous years, but I think we saw a really entertaining race. But if you ask me, it was a little artificial.
So that begs the question: then, is generating a different winner a sign that this is successful? Is this what people wanted? For me, I want to see interesting racing that has developed organically. This does not do that. I think there's also the safety aspect that you have to put into effect. And, I mean, for Rebellion, the other side of this is, all right, you go and get the win now, but they know that they're about to get hammered with some success handicap, and they're not going to have another chance like this for a very long time, if ever, left in the WEC season, and that doesn't really sit that well with me either.
Well, yeah, and we'll see what happens in Bahrain. The system is so complicated. Myself and two other journalists were like trying to come to grips with what potentially changed since Fuji, because we were under the understanding that perhaps the coefficient changed again, and the coefficient is kind of the base multiplier used to calculate this success handicap, and half the teams didn't even know what was going on. I don't think anybody in the paddock even knows how this is calculated. And if journalists don't understand, if if engineers don't understand, and I don't think the fans even understand. So this is definitely not my favorite type of racing. I understand that we can't have the Toyotas parade around and win by five laps again like we've seen in the previous season. It's great to see a new team in victory lane. You know, this is Rebellion's first win on the road in WEC competition. They obviously won Silverstone in 18, but that was inherited after the Toyotas were disqualified post-race. So this was a big day for the team, and you have to sort of give it to them as well. There's been a lot of shakeup in that organization over the last couple of years. They're largely Orica run now. There's only a handful of crew guys from the ex Seba run operation from Bart Hayden. So, you know, the development of the car has been ongoing. They went down to one car this year for the full season because of some budget issues. So it's a great story to see these guys in victory lane. And I think they might still have a chance at a couple other races. Bahrain, the way the success handicap works, it might actually still be okay for them in Bahrain, because they'll lose some performance to Toyota, but Toyota's not going to gain anything from this, because it all goes back to the base car, which I believe is still the number six Ginetta as the lowest placed LMP1 car in the championship. So I think as this season evolves, everybody should be getting closer and closer to the same performance. But the problem is, as you point out on the safety side, everybody gets their performance in different ways, and that's where there's a big concern. I was incredibly surprised there was no accidents in the race between an LMP1 car and other traffic LMP2 cars. There were some outspoken drivers post-race in GT and LMP2. I'm talking about how they had to navigate around the LMP1 cars. Actually, there were GT cars passing the LMP1 cars at points of the track too, just because specifically the Toyotas, they were limited so much on their boost. They had no top end speed at all. It was very difficult to pass cars. They were getting passed by LMP2s in a straight line regularly, and GTs were almost even passing them too. So I think this definitely was a wake-up call. Is this what the ACO and FIA really wanted? Is this what they expected? Those questions are still to be answered, but I think, from a pure entertainment standpoint, it was a great race, but I don't know what we'll see exactly in Bahrain, but if the rules stay as they are, technically it could be an even closer fight there.
Well, to your point earlier, despite my misgivings, you're right. It is a good story about Rebellion. Certainly none of this takes away from what they accomplished. They're playing with the same rule book as everyone else, and they took advantage of it, and all credit to them for that. And another great story, too, was Bruno Senna becoming the first driver to win in all four WEC classes. That's a pretty remarkable achievement, it has to be said.
Yeah, kind of a surprise there too. It's like, you know, it's once you get these new teams into victory lane, sometimes you get some new achievements. And Bruno's definitely been a stalwart of the WEC almost from the very beginning. So great to see that, and it was great to see that.
Well, we'll leave the LMP1 discussion here, and I'd point out that if you have comments, we'd love to hear what you thought of the race. If you want to leave us a comment in the comment section or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter, really curious what the fans thought about the race as well, because if the entertainment value was improved, that does go a long way to justify some of these changes and even some of the artificial nature of them, but perhaps there's another side to it as well. So I'd love to hear what the fans have to say about that. You can leave a comment, as I said, in the comment section or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter, and we'll address it on our next show. Let's go to LMP2 now, John, where Jota had a dominant outing with a 1-2 finish between a couple of teams that it's associated with.
Yeah, the Jota-badged number 38 Orica took the win with Anthony Davidson, Antonio Felix da Costa, and Roberto Gonzalez over the sister Jackie Chan DC Racing car, which led early. I think those two cars combined to lead all but one lap in LMP2, which was quite remarkable. A really dominant performance. Jota's first win since Spa 2015 under that team's banner, but obviously have achieved much more success since then with the Jackie Chan DC Racing cars. This was also the first class win for Goodyear and only its third race back in international sports car racing. No doubt tires played a big factor in the race, I think, in all four classes, but I think this performance we saw by Jota was a lot of credit to Goodyear and the way their tires were on this very challenging track here in Shanghai in terms of tire degradation. So I think a lot of the credit to this victory not only came from the drivers, but how they managed the tires. Anthony Davidson said post-race that it was kind of like having a conservation run in a way, where knowing you had this corner and that corner to go, and you had a hit your apex there, but then conserve in this area or that area. And he said he really enjoyed it because, unlike F1, he didn't have somebody, you know, yabbering in his ear, telling him what to do. He was actually kind of like one in the car by himself. And he said it was a real rewarding experience to be able to achieve a victory, you know, by having the best overall performance per se, while being on a somewhat conservative run, because this weekend being a 4-hour race, there was limited tire allocations. Teams had a double stint and strategies were definitely at play. So I think that's one of the key factors in the LMP2 race. And overall, it was a huge day for Jota and Goodyear.
And tires were a part of the story in GTE Pro as well, but certainly not the only story, with AF Corsa winning on the road. But an infraction in post-race scrutineering, a ground clearance issue, led to AF Corsa losing the win that promoted Porsche to the top spot. There's a lot to dissect here, but unfortunately it means another race winner, at least when the checkered flag flies, ultimately loses it after the fact, which, as we've discussed before, is a bit frustrating, I think. But not much that can be done in this case, because the car clearly did not pass the scrutineering exam.
Yes, but AF Corsa has lodged an appeal to this because they claim that it was caused by damage on the track. So from what I understand, the car is going to be sealed up in the container before heading into Bahrain, and they're waiting for a hearing at the FIA Court of Appeals. So this one may not be settled for a few months, so stay tuned on that. But for the time being, we can say that it was another Porsche 1-2. Promoted Michael Christensen and Kevin Estra to the win. They extend their points lead. Another amazing start to the season for Porsche, I think, especially with the brand new car here with the 2019 spec RSR. But I think there was really, this race had a bunch of different elements, you know, not just post-race, but for Aston Martin, they were the dominant car throughout the race. The number 95 Vantage GTE of Marco Sorensen and Nicky Tim, until a puncture for that car with, I think, about 70 minutes to go, put them out of the order, led the debris on the track, and that ultimately brought out a full course yellow to clean up the debris that screwed up their strategy, along with some other teams, and sort of put the number 51 Ferrari in position to take the win on the road. And that would have been a really popular victory for James Collado and Alessandro Pierguidi, as both said post-race that they weren't expecting to win. They usually struggled in Shanghai. This would have been Ferrari's first win in Shanghai, believe it or not. So, lots of different talking points here in GTE Pro.
And GTE Am saw the second consecutive class win for TF Sport drivers Johnny Adam and Charlie Eastwood, along with Sava Yolick, picking up the class win in GTE Am. So there's a lot more to be said, of course. Plenty of coverage from Shanghai post-race notebooks throughout the weekend as well. Lots of reaction all at sportscar365.com if you want more coverage from the WEC round in Shanghai. Up next, though, we'll turn our attention to the news of the week on Double Stint.
Hi, I'm Guy Smith. You're listening to Sports Car 365's Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint, time to get to the news of the week. And John, some big news out of Toyota. We've been talking a lot in recent weeks and months about the potential integration in future regulations of the next set of DPI regs and the forthcoming hypercar class in the WEC. And it sounds like one of the major sticking points might not be such a sticking point after all. I think there was some question about whether Toyota would welcome a platform that costs a fraction of the budget that Toyota is going to be putting towards its hypercar program in the DPI regs, but it sounds like that might not be an issue.
Yeah, speaking to Pascal Vassilon over the weekend, the team's technical director, we sort of asked him point blank, are you open to DPIs being integrated into the top class of the WEC, you know, theoretically, because obviously this has not been confirmed. We know both sides, IMSA and ACO, are working towards this. And there have been, like you said, Ryan, some sticking points, both from a technical standpoint in that the Toyota is a four-wheel drive car, effectively, the hypercar is. And how does that balance with DPIs, which are rear-wheel driven, and then road-based hypercars, as in the case of the Aston Martin? But still, you know, the big question was, will a manufacturer of the caliber of Toyota that's investing money in a brand new hypercar, would they be open to this? And Pascal seemed to think so. He said they don't have any issues, as long they have no problems with whatever cars they race against, as long as it's on an equal playing field, and as long as they, Toyota, can still showcase the technology that they intend to showcase, which is a bespoke hybrid system, a higher powered hybrid system than what we were expecting to see in IMSA with the DPI. And obviously the DPI 2022 platform will be a spec hybrid, and Pascal was clear to say that, you know, we don't want to go to a spec hybrid system. There's no way our hypercar will be doing that. But if we're racing against cars in that configuration, we're okay, because we do need more manufacturers in the class. We need more commitments to grow this new top class of the championship. So I definitely think that was some very encouraging news and development. We're still some ways away from potentially seeing this all materialize. I spoke to Gerard Nouveau over the weekend as well, and he said there were some very positive developments in the last few weeks. They're still working. They're still talking with IMSA. He's actually scheduled to go make a visit to Daytona in the coming weeks to continue dialogue with the sanctioning body there to see what can be done to potentially make this happen. And I think with Toyota's blessing, this could actually become a reality.
That's really good news. If integration is something you're interested in, it certainly is for me, so happy to hear that. Some other WEC news that you gathered from over the weekend. We knew that the plan, of course, was to return to Brazil for the championship, but that round at Interlagos sounds like it could be hitting some problems at this point. John, what did you learn, and what is the latest about WEC and its calendar with the planned return to Interlagos later this year?
Yeah, this was one of the big talking points of the weekend. Teams up and down the paddock were sort of questioning what's going to happen, because this race is coming up in February. It's actually scheduled for the week after the Rolex 24. So still two races to go in the WEC calendar, because we head to Bahrain next in December. So, but the big question is, what will happen to Sao Paulo? I spoke to Gerard. He confirmed that they have, quote, serious doubts and concerns, unquote, over the future of the race. It seems to be financially driven. They had this event was initially announced in March of 2018 under a new promoter. Emerson Fittipaldi had been the previous promoter of the event when it ran from 2012 to 2014. That event had some financial difficulties as well. That's why we didn't see it return to the calendar. And it seemed like this was all going to be a fresh, clean slate, lots of excitement building in the city. And the way Gerard put it is that some deadlines haven't been met. Quote, when you organize an event, there's intermediate steps. Sometimes you're late or you're in advance, and sometimes you're looking for where you are. And that's clearly what's happened in Brazil right now. We have some concerns because they're late in different parameters, unquote. So that's all we know for now. Girard said that a decision is definitely going to be made within the next 2 weeks in order to give teams enough time to plan alternative arrangements. He's urged teams to hold off on travel plans and preparations for this race for the time being, and the WEC is exploring alternate locations for this race.
So what are the contingency plans? Where might they race if the Interlagos round can't go forward?
Well, Girard wouldn't tell me exactly, and I guess that's understandable, but we understand that Circuit of the Americas and Kyalami are the two likely scenarios, because basically you have to find a race that's on the way to Sebring from Bahrain. Everything's being shipped by boat, and there's not many options. You know, Girard already told me that you're not racing in Europe that time of year in February. That's ruled out. You have to go somewhere else. But with the way the logistics are, it looks like Kyalami would actually make a lot of sense. I know that track has been in discussions for a round on the next season schedule, 2020-2021. So a last-minute race there in South Africa could actually be a reality. Also, you know, we have COTA that has been a previous round of the championship for a number of years. Mexico City's actually been mentioned as well, but I think that's more unlikely given the financial situation there as well. That was the reason why we didn't go back to that race a couple years ago. So the bottom line is we should have an answer in the next couple weeks. So that way everything could be sorted. But I guess disappointed in a way, because a lot of drivers were looking forward to going to Sao Paulo. And let's be clear, it's not a done deal yet. It's not officially off the schedule. But personally, the way it's looking, I think it looks a bit unlikely at this stage. So that's why WEC is making plans for plan B or plan C right now.
And speaking of WEC scheduling, there was some thought that we might see some shakeup on the calendar looking ahead to 2020-2021, and it sounds like that could affect the race that you just attended in Shanghai.
Yeah, it looks like, again, let's just say looks, it's not official, no official comment on this, but it appears that Shanghai will not return in 2020-2021, basically on the case of lack of team interest, lack of manufacturer interest in the Chinese market. Specifically, the manufacturers are competing right now in the WEC. One of the driving factors of this event was the significant activation in the series by the Volkswagen Group. And now that Porsche's gone from LMP1, Audi's gone, there's not as much activation at the track. Toyota, actually, for China, China's one of their smallest markets, I believe. They don't do any activation at all. You know, it's an important market for others like Aston Martin and Ferrari and whatnot, but I don't think it's enough to keep it on the schedule, considering all the loops we have to go through just to get to this race every year, with teams getting visas and lots of challenges always around this race. And Girard indicated that, you know, races can come and go. You know, maybe in 3 or 4 years from now, if there's a bunch of manufacturers back interested in the WEC, a round could be re-added to the calendar. I think that could be in direct reference to a possibility of China being dropped for a couple of years and maybe returning a couple of years later, as if the hypercar class rebuilds and there's more manufacturers that want to be in this market. But I get the feeling that Shanghai will probably not return. There's a lot of other things in the works too, and you can check out the story on SportsCard 365 about that. The WEC sent out a questionnaire to teams asking them to rank the current races in terms of importance, as well as ranking other potential new events in terms of importance. And they sort of dished out some names that were pretty surprising. Tracks like the Bend Motorsport Park in Australia, the new track being built in St. Petersburg, Russia, Kyalami, as we mentioned earlier, Sepang, Monza. So it looks like WEC is really taking, you know, really asking for feedback from their competitors, seeing where the teams want to go. We have to remember right now, this is a largely privateer-driven championship. I think close to two-thirds of the cars are Pro-Am entries right now as we await the hopeful return rejuvenation of the LMP1, the top class with more manufacturers. So I think this is a really smart move. We'll see what happens in the 2021 calendar. There's also a possibility of a ninth round being added. Personally, I don't think that's the right time to be doing it when we're in this kind of transition here. But Toyota's for having a ninth round. Speaking to Pascal about that, he says they would welcome that decision. So we'll see what happens there, but the calendar will be released at the next round in Bahrain, so we'll have a definite clearer picture by then.
Okay, not too far down the road. Well, let's switch gears and go to some IMSA news, where Aston Martin is closing in on perhaps having a full-time GTD program. It's been quite a while since we've seen Aston on a regular basis in what is now the WeatherTech Championship.
Yeah, you have to go back to TRG when they ran a car with Christina Nielsen. I think it was in the second year of the post-merger era. So this would definitely be a welcome development as well. And speaking to Aston Martin Racing Managing Director John Gaw, he said they're extremely close to a deal. They're very confident. Again, it's still negotiations. Things can always happen. But we should know within the next few weeks, especially given how close Daytona is. It would be a full season program minus the Sprint Cup rounds. So it would this team would not take part in the races at Long Beach and Detroit. We don't know the identity of the team. That's the other question right now as well. And I've done some head scratching in the last few days and haven't been able to pin it down to anybody specific. But John indicated that if this does happen, they would most likely lend a factory driver. So this would be a substantial effort to the class. And again, if it happens, it would actually most likely result in the 10th manufacturer in GTD. Granted that if McLaren returns, at least with a Sprint Cup program. So that makes it quite an incredible achievement, not only for Aston Martin, if they're able to do it, but for IMSA and having so many manufacturers represented on the GTD grid. Let's wait and see. You know, there's contracts that have to be signed and everything, but this was definitely an encouraging development that I ran across over the weekend.
And staying in GTD, we know that Ben Keating's primary focus will be on the WEC, but still he plans on being a presence in the IMSA paddock in a limited capacity. What is the latest on what Ben might be planning for the upcoming season?
Yeah, so I think we all sort of assumed that he would be running in a Mercedes for the Michelin Endurance Cup races, and that is still the case, but it's actually going to be joining Lawson Aschenbach and Gar Robinson in the full season Riley car and not actually an additional Mercedes. So personally, that comes as a bit of a disappointment because I thought we were going to see two Riley entered Mercedes for those Endurance Cup races. It turns out it'll only be one. Ben explained to me that the reasoning behind this is cost related. Definitely, if he's just able to jump on board with the existing team, it doesn't cost as much. And also, he has some concerns over the Mercedes Evo package for the 2020 IMSA season specifically. Nothing about the package in general. He thinks it's a great step forward with the car, but he's concerned with how the balance of performance is going to occur with that package. Because what we saw this year was quite an interesting divide between the Evo packages that were debuted in IMSA. We saw the Acura NSX GT3 Evo and Lamborghini both really show its strides throughout the year, where the Audi Evo struggled massively. And Ben sort of seemed to indicate that IMSA may not be so generous, or maybe be under more scrutiny on making sure the Evos don't outperform the competition, quote unquote, in what, you know, as a situation we saw this year. So he says he doesn't want to put the investment into buying an Evo kit for his car. He owns two. I think he owns a total of three Mercedes AMG GT3s. One of them, I think, is being sold to the Robinsons for this program with Riley. And then Ben's going to look to sell another one and keep one in his collection for the long term. But yeah, this is to me, a bit of a disappointing development that we'll only see one Riley entered Mercedes for the Endurance Cup and full season. Jerome Bleekemolen could be the fourth driver for Daytona, but that's only if he doesn't land a full season seat elsewhere in IMSA. Speaking with him over the weekend as well, he indicated it's a really tough driver market. He used to have calls every year from teams when he was even employed with Ben for a full season, you know, teams inquiring about his availability. And this year he hasn't received a single call. And I think that sort of shows how the driver market is right now in America. There's a lot of drivers on the sidelines looking for rides and very few opportunities. So, yeah, that's the update there from the Riley, Ben Keating side.
Okay, good update there. Thank you. A couple other things to get to here in the news segment. This was an interesting story. Stefan Rattel talking about the fact that it's unlikely that the SRO is going to be going after a new title sponsor for its top GT series. And the rationale for it, I thought, was quite interesting, basically to help give more brand identity to the GT World Challenge and Intercontinental GT Challenge brands that he's unveiled here in the last 3 years or so.
Yeah, and I think this makes a lot of sense because you look at the 20, I think it's 26 years of history of SRO now, not counting the World Challenge side of things in America because they just celebrated their 30th anniversary. But looking at what Stefan has built and developed over the years, the names have always changed. It started with BPR, then the FIA GT Championship, then FIA GT1 World Championship, then Blancpain GT Series, and now we're at GT World Challenge. And so when you ask somebody about where you're racing or where you have raced, you sort of get confused in the mix, and you compare it to other series throughout the years, and you could just say, you know, oh, I've raced in IMSA. And IMSA has such a strong brand identity. And I think that's something that Stefan's trying to build with these GT World Challenge and Intercontinental GT Challenge brands. And instead of having a sponsor in front of it, he's looking for a sponsor behind it. So as the case we see with IGTC powered by Pirelli, I think that's the kind of sponsorship and activation he's looking for in the GT World Challenge brand now. Nothing on the horizon right now. I don't think we'll see anything for 2020, but an interesting development for sure. And I guess it makes a lot of sense when it comes down to it. I still have my own questions with the name itself, World Challenge, when you're racing in regional championships, you know, in America and Asia and Europe. I understand the concept of World Challenge and that there is a World Challenge title for manufacturers based on those three series, but for a regular observer of the championship, if you're saying you're racing World Challenge Europe, it sort of contradicts each other. The name Europe and World shouldn't be in the same title. But then again, I'm not Stefan. He's been the visionary in GT3 racing and GT racing around the world. So I'm not gonna doubt his reasoning here for that.
Yeah, we'll defer to Stefan on this particular topic. Finally, staying in the SRO, we had another shakeup to the GT World Challenge America's schedule. It's gone through a couple of different iterations, but it was announced that Circuit of the Americas is back for the GT3 cars. The schedule remains 6 races, and so what that means is the previously announced Intercontinental GT Challenge powered by Pirelli round at Indianapolis, which was originally set to be a points-paying event for GT World Challenge America, now becomes optional as far as the GT World Challenge America points championship is concerned.
Yeah, I think this is a huge development in the development of the Indianapolis 8-hour race. I know Stefan was personally very adamant that they needed full-season World Challenge America entries in order to bolster the grid for this new event. And this was his plan to make that happen. I know not everybody within SRO America agreed with that reasoning. And now we've seen this development where COTA is returned to the schedule. I get the sense why COTA's returned, because otherwise the season wouldn't have started until the middle of May at CTMP, and that would have put a lot at risk in terms of generating entries for the championship. But at the same time, I think it was important to keep Indy on the schedule in order to ensure a strong grid for that race, because in effect, we could end up with a repeat of what we've seen with the California 8 hours in the last couple of years, where it's a very small grid of mainly European-based or full-season intercontinental entries. So I know costs were a big factor too. You know, a lot of GT World Challenge America teams were concerned about the 8 hour in terms of the costs. So there's a lot of factors to consider. It's a yet another change to the calendar. I think this is the third or fourth time now since July, and we still haven't seen the calendar for GT4 America and the various championships around that for next year. So, yeah, I'll say I'm a bit disappointed by this, but at the same time, I understand. Let's see what happens. I'm still a little worried about the state of GT3 with SRO in America right now, considering there's quite a few teams that look to be exiting the series for next year and really wondering where we're going to be finding new teams for 2020.
Yeah, this one caught me off guard, specifically leaving Indianapolis out of the full season, primarily because after it was announced, I went and talked to just about as many teams about it as I could, expecting it to get more pushback, and ultimately I found it to be quite popular with most of the team owners and team principals that I spoke to. They acknowledged, yeah, the cost is going to be higher, but there is some benefit for the additional cost that comes with racing at Indianapolis and racing as part of the IGTC. So I didn't really get the sense that it was super unpopular to begin with. I guess if you have to, they feel like they need to start the season earlier, and I think they did, and I think they're probably right about that, then something has to give, and maybe this makes the most sense. But I'm with you. I'm disappointed. I was looking forward to seeing a really stout GT3 grid at Indy, and I do wonder now what kind of turnout we're going to get. But anyway, that's just my thoughts on the subject. Anyway, you can find more on those stories, plus other stories, such as Acura confirming its driver lineup at IMSA with Acura Team Penske for the upcoming season. Also, Acura Team Penske driver Dane Cameron will be joining Honda for the IGTC round at Kyalami. And Magnussen has his racing plans for next season at least partially figured out, racing in TCR Denmark. We saw a story about DTM talking about its vision for an electric series with electric and hydrogen cars and robotic pit stops, possibly the future for them, and an update on Steven Simpson's plans for next year. All of those stories and more can be found at sportscar365.com. But for now, we need to take a break, and on the other side, John's conversation with Gustavo Menezes, who is part of the winning driver lineup at Shanghai for Rebellion. That's next on Double Stint.
Hi, I'm Andy Prio, and you're listening to the Sports Car 365's Double Stint podcast.
We're here with Gustavo Menezes. Overall victory here in the 4 hours of Shanghai. First overall win for Rebellion Racing on the road. Your second career WEC win. Talk me through the race. It seemed like a pretty epic battle here early on. And when you got in the car, you basically took over the lead from that point.
Yeah, honestly, it was, for me, a very special feeling because truly that was the first real win where it was earned and deserved. And to celebrate it with our team and see the emotional status of everyone there and the hard work they put, I'm very grateful for everyone at Rebellion Racing. They really deserve this win today. Although maybe the success handicap is just part of the deal of the championship, although it might have been a little bit more in our favor than a perfect BOP world, I would say it's very clear for the fans and for the championship that it is the first time we've seen real racing in this series in a very long time. And we need a lot more of that if we want to see WEC in a healthy place in the future. I think if we can take and they can learn from this weekend, it was amazing. I've never seen so many replays of overtaking between the LMP1 class. I'm sure it's a record in a very long time. And so to see that is it's special. And hopefully at Le Mans, they can do something to make it a real race.
You took over the lead in the second hour after the opening stint by Norman. He seemed to struggle on the tires. Was that the case in trying to get things, you know, the tire deg and just getting a balance in the car? Or?
Yeah, honestly, we saw that the tires that were used in qualifying really did pay a toll immediately. There was no rear grip on them. And you can see that when Bruno changed the rear tires into a second stint, he found a second and a half. So poor Norman struggled a little bit with that situation, as well as the tires not being at prime temperature. I don't know exactly the situation there, but our car struggles massively when the tires are under the window, which they were. And as you can see, we were fighting head-to-head with the P2s for the first two or three laps. But once things got going, we were good. And when I got the car, I just gave it everything I had. And it was enough to build a margin and give Bruno the car in a good place.
What does this mean for the team? I know it's been a long time coming. You guys finally get to celebrate on the top step of the podium with all the fanfare involved here. What does this mean for Rebellion, a privateer team, and all the work that's gone into this car and package over the last 2 years?
It's simply everything. I mean, that is the motivation the team needed. It's the incentive the championship needed, the fans and the drivers. As I've said before, there hasn't been a fight in the WEC and LMP1 in a very long time, and it needed that. And I hope that throughout this season we can see a lot more of that. But truly ecstatic for everyone in the team.
How was fighting through traffic for you? Obviously you had a speed advantage top line, but the Toyotas were at a bit of a disadvantage this weekend with the way the success handicap was. Do you think it was safe and fair out there for getting around traffic and how things unfolded from your standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, it is the success handicap, so if it were to be true BOP, it would have been a little bit different. I think they would have had a little bit more and it would have been balanced a little bit more even, but it was the closest we've seen it. We did have an advantage top speed wise. They had a bit of an advantage torque wise, as well as the rear wheel drives losing traction. You can see in the second stints that we struggled a little bit more on the exits of the corners with the Toyotas, but I wouldn't call it unfair on any side. I think our pace through traffic was very similar, so it definitely eliminated the advantage they usually do have through traffic. So, yeah.
And what does this mean sort of going into Bahrain, final race of the calendar year, still in the middle of now this winter championship in the WEC? What kind of momentum does this give you guys?
And motivation-wise, it gives us a ton, but realistically, we do know that we're going to suffer massively from the success handicap, so we're just going to do the best we can and see where we end up.
All right, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Martin Tomczyk, and you're listening to Sportscar 365's Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint, thanks to Gustavo for his time after the big victory over the weekend. John, let's get to some listener questions. We had a couple that came in the comment section last week. The first one from Goncalo Sants 2084, who says, "Hi, John. Any rumors or word about next year's Mazda drivers? Is it possible that the former 4GT drivers land a seat due to the Multimatic connections? Also, any word about Visit Florida and a Mazda customer program?"
Well, in regards to the former 4GT drivers potentially with Mazda, that was my first guess. And that was something I was really investigating during the Petit Le Mans weekend. And ultimately, from what I can tell, as we sit here today, there are no full season lineup changes to the Mazda team. Endurance Cup-wise, I'm not entirely sure. I believe Olivier Pla and Timo Bernard are back, but I'm still no 100% word there. In regards to a Visit Florida Mazda customer program, I think it would be a Spirit of Daytona if that happens. It seems to have gone a bit quiet in recent weeks. And speaking to some people over there in the last month, I would say, it looks like if it happens, it would most likely be a limited season program only. We know that Harrison Newey had tested a Mazda at Portimao one of the tracks in Spain or Portugal. I don't remember where they were at. It might have been Algarve, but there was a test in Europe a few months back, and Harrison was testing there. I got some further developments there on what Harrison may be doing next year. He spent a full year in Super Formula, and now he's at the point of deciding whether he's going to go full-time sports car racing next year or stay in the open wheel ranks. So he was one of the key components to this program, this third car, from what I understand. So I think that everything's still a bit up in the air, but as we get closer to Daytona, I think the chances of a third car up here would make it more and more unlikely to happen if we don't have any announcement.
Okay, next question comes from Edgar Sanchez, who writes, "Since KCMG is only doing Bathurst and considering changing cars, does that mean Nissan is out of the IGTC? Will we see any Nissans racing outside of Japan in 2020?
Yeah, I think that's safe to assume that Nissan will not be a manufacturer for Intercontinental GT Challenge next year. Stefan Reitel is expecting that as well. He said there's a lot of developments happening with that brand right now in with the GT3 car. He seemed a bit disappointed, actually, not to see the car racing more globally. And I guess there is a good chance of it being really relegated to Japan only next year. Basically, it comes down to, I think, a lot of budgets are not available for the car outside of Japan. Nissan has been going through a lot financially and from a business standpoint. They're putting a lot of their support into Formula E, and I think there's really no big backer for this GT3 car at the moment. You know, we had RJN kind of as the de facto factory team in Europe. They're no longer part of the program. We had some teams in America run them over the course of the years, including the AIM Autosport operation. They've moved on, obviously, with the Lexus program with Vassar Sullivan. So I don't think the GTR GT3 has a really encouraging future right now at this point, especially as I'm a little curious if they've actually built 20 cars. And there's an FIA mandate saying within the first 2 years of your launch, you need 20 cars built in order to be eligible as an FIA GT3 spec car. So there actually could be more serious problems on the horizon with this package. I haven't been able to confirm how many cars Nissan has actually built.
Okay, interesting stuff. Thank you very much for writing in, and if you have a question or comment for next week's show, you too can have your question on the program. Just leave it in the comment section or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter. But that brings us to a close for this week's show. Thank you very much for tuning in. We'd appreciate a rating and a review on iTunes, and we look forward to talking to you next week with our next edition of Double Stint.